and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Happy Halloween to you. And if you're not Catholic, you're welcome. Yes, Catholic Church invented Halloween. We're happy to share, but credit where credit is due. And a big no to those of you who are yelling at the radio. Halloween is not a pagan festival appropriated by the Catholic Church. We hear that about just about every Christian holiday, and it's in almost every case, not true. We have a great show for you this All Hallows Eve, starting with a conversation about crisis moments in the history of the church. Without question, we're living through tough times right now, almost certainly one of the crisis moments in the history of the church. So we take a look back today at how the church has responded to crises throughout the many centuries. Our number, 888-318-7884. If you would like to get in on that conversation, we'd love to have you. 888-318-7884. Our guest is Dr. Italy, Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio. He hosts a series on EWTN on the virtues, Seven Habits of Champions. He received his doctorate in theology under Cardinal Avery Dulles of blessed memory. A prolific writer and speaker, Dr. D'Ambrosio's books include Exploring the Catholic Church, When the Church Was Young, Voices of the Early Fathers, and 40 Days, 40 Ways, A New Look at Lent. You can find all about him at dritaly.com. Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, thank you for being with us.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Si. It's been a while, man.
It has been a while, and I'm so pleased to have you back. And this is kind of not new territory for you. I mean, among the talks that you give is a talk about the crisis moments in the history of this church.
Yes, indeed. And you know what, Si? Every talk I've given, and I've given a lot since August, but just about everybody wants me at least to mention the elephant in the room, and that is the crisis that we're all grappling with. That's,
right.
You know, the one thing after another, the disclosures about Cardinal McCarrick, and then the PA district attorney report coming out, and then, Archbishop Vigano's letters. So anyway, we've been kind of, we're a little rope-a-dope here, been hit. Everybody who loves the church is dismayed, and those who don't love the church are dismayed. It doesn't matter. It's not a happy spectacle. So yeah,
right.
It's something that needs to be addressed, and I've been addressing it ever since. It's been coming up so much since August.
So it probably, I mean, real as far as crises go, the church, you know, did pretty good for maybe the first 1,000 years, 1,500 years, right? There were no real crises early in the life of the church. That's when everything was rosy and good.
Everything was perfect.
Okay.
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. I'm so glad you got that straight, Si.
Yeah. I'm a real historian.
Yeah, you know, it's really important to know that issues with clergy and crisis with clergy, disedifying, scandalous behavior, goes back to the Old Testament times. I mean, if people pick up their Bible, read 1 Samuel 4. You know, everyone remembers a story about Samuel, the little boy in the temple. And, you know, here I am, the Lord speaking to Samuel when he's a little boy, and Eli telling him, just say, here I am, Lord. Well, Eli, the priest, the message that Samuel got was to chew out Eli and tell him he's going to be judged because he was not dealing with the sexual abuse and the financial abuse of his sons who were priests, and what they were doing to the people of Israel. Now, you can read right about all about that. It was financial abuse, stealing offerings from the Lord, asking people for more than was the priest due, and sexual abuse of women working at the door of the temple. So, you know, and Eli was a nice guy, but he wasn't strong enough. He gave a mild rebuke to his sons and didn't stop them.
Yeah.
So the Lord caused them to be defeated in battle, the ark to be captured, his sons to be killed, and Eli to fall over dead when he heard the news. So, you know, what we're experiencing, everything from the cover-up or ineffective discipline to the kind of abuse, that goes back to the Old Testament. And, of course, we actually do see it, sad to say, as soon as, you know, the Lord chooses people. He chooses 12, and one of them betrays the Lord. And later on, Paul, who was born out of due course, wasn't one of the original 12, but he writes a letter to Timothy, 1 Timothy. And, you know, the love of money is the root of all evil. That phrase, everyone knows that. It's given in context of a priest or presbyter who has succumbed to the love of money. So even in New Testament times, there are clergy who succumb to the world, the flesh, and the devil. And the big temptations are temptation to power, temptation to sexual abuse, temptation to financial abuse. So that stuff is nothing new in the life of the church. It's sad, and we should root it out where we can, but it's nothing new at all.
Is it at all unusual for the – it really seems like this is a – well, I don't know. As I'm asking the question, I'm not even sure that it's right what I'm about to say. But it seems like this crisis in particular is a crisis that comes right out of the heart of the church. And maybe we're more used to thinking about persecutions and those things from outside. Maybe I'm thinking about that wrong, though. I don't know. Is the current crisis unusual in that regard, or is this common for us to kind of have crumbling from within?
No. The biggest danger, of course, is crumbling from within. The church persecuted from without becomes stronger. In the first three centuries, there were schisms from within that caused problems. The persecution from without was the seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. But even in the first three centuries, we were struggling with heresies and schisms on small scales, local scales. And then very soon after, as soon as Christianity became legal, we had a huge struggle with certain clergy, small number, but very, very crafty, who were pushing a new agenda to change church teaching, basically saying that Jesus wasn't equal to God. And that was we needed an ecumenical council. But even after that council, for 55 years, it was a knockdown, drag out fight to put down this heresy, which the council had put down on paper. But unfortunately, councils, we have this idea that, wow, it's really crazy. After Vatican II, it seems like all hell broke loose. That seems to prove that Vatican II wasn't really of God. Nope, because after every council, unfortunately, all hell breaks loose. There's always a struggle, and there's always, unfortunately, a battle, and that battle is oftentimes severe and leads to schism or leads to division. So division is a horrible thing, and scandals are a horrible thing. The Lord tells us it's better for a person to have a millstone tied around his neck and be thrown into the sea than to give offense to one of my little ones. So people who do cause scandal, it's nothing to be taken lightly. It's a terrible thing. So we ought to be really, really careful ourselves. And if we ever do cause scandal, repent seriously and do some serious, serious reparation and penance. But on the other hand, we can't be scandalized or allow it. You know, a stumbling block, scandal means stumbling block. Okay. And, some of us are able to have a stumbling block in our path, and we're nimble enough by the power of the Holy Spirit to jump over it. But others of us allow that stumbling block to knock us down and keep us from walking in the way of the Lord. So for those who put the stumbling block in the way, woe is you. But all of us, we can't help it if stumbling blocks are laid across our path. We need to learn how to jump over them and look at the presence of the Lord in the church. The thing that I think is most important, Cy, is if this were simply a human institution, the Catholic Church, it would have fallen apart a long time ago like most other human movements and human governments, okay? But the fact that this church has produced saints in every generation and is still here today is testimony that the church is something more than a merely human reality. It is a reality that is empowered, guided by the Holy Spirit, that has the Spirit really as its soul. The soul of the church is the Spirit. Now, some of the members are – all of us who are still struggling below here are imperfect. Some of us who are imposters. Some of us are hypocrites, you know. But the church itself is the mother, as Pope Francis recently said. And it's the Spirit that's keeping it alive and moving. And it contains within it the source of life and salvation, which is Christ itself, because it's Christ's body.
Do you personally, when you think about the big crises in the, I will ask you when we come back from the break about what are the really big ones and how does it compare with today, the crises in the history of the church. But do you, in a way, take a sense of comfort away from reflecting back on them? Like, oh, it's, we've gone through times before that seem like they might be the end.
Way worse. We've gone times before, gone through stuff that's just unbelievable over the last 2,000 years. And it does give me great comfort. It gives me a tremendous sense of gratitude that the Lord has been faithful, even when many have been severely unfaithful and none of us have been perfectly faithful. The Lord is faithful. And he said that the gates of hell would not prevail, and they have not. So thanks be to God for that. Again, it doesn't mean we're complacent and we acquiesce to evil and corruption. No, we go after it. But we don't let the presence of evil and corruption knock us down and cause us to focus on the enemy. That's what the enemy wants, for us to be disheartened and to focus on him. He basically is poking his finger in our eyes here through this stuff. He's crafty. And so he wants to disedify. He wants to use the sins of members and clergy to dishearten the rank and file and to keep people away from Jesus. That's his point. So we can't let him do that.
We're talking about crisis moments in the history of the Catholic Church. Our guest is Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio. Our number, 888-318-7884. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, 888-318-7884. It's not much longer to be with us, but we still have the store-wide fall sale underway. You go to shop.catholic.com, and it's 20% off hundreds of items in the online store, including books, DVDs, CDs, MP3s, ebooks, BBD, shibidibid. I just made those last two up. I don't know if those are real. But the way you do it is you put in the promo code CALIVE18 when you check out at shop.catholic.com and save on everything today.
Catholic Answers Live. The only thing missing from today's broadcast is you. Call now with your question.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The Church has 2,000 years of wisdom to share on what it takes to live life gracefully.
And we're so overwhelmed by how much our faith has transformed our marriage and family especially. We want everyone to experience the incredible gift that the Catholic vision of life and love really is.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to our Super Halloween edition of Catholic Answers Live. Second hour, our chaplain will be here, Father Hugh Barber, and we're going to take questions of a pastoral nature. If you have something you need a chaplain for, that is the time to call. The number, the same as it is this hour, 888-318-7884. This hour, we're talking about, well, moments of crisis in the history of the Church with Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, who well, you were saying you've been giving lots of talks, and it doesn't matter what you're talking about these days, people want to know about the crisis in the Church. Maybe give us a little history of some of these, of the real major crises the Church has gone through.
Sure. Well, here's a couple. One, right after the Council of Nicaea that gave us the core of the creed that we say every Sunday, you know, that council came together to make clear, to clarify the Church's teaching on whether or not Jesus was truly equal to the Father. Church had always believed that, but some folks, very crafty folks, led by a man named Arius, a priest, they had been very effective in weakening a number of people's faith in that and making a big case that he wasn't equal to God the Father. And so anyway, the Church says, okay, we're going to have a council. It's the first council of this kind since the Council of Jerusalem way back in Acts 15. And that happened in 325 AD. So in that council, there was a vote, you know, and the vote was very clear. It was over 300-3 or so and voted on this creed. Only three people would not sign the creed. One of them was the leader of this heresy, Arius. And so he and two of his episcopal sponsors were excommunicated and exiled. Well, within a few years, they were back, and they were just worming their way into the episcopacy and speaking into the ear of the Emperor Constantine and his sons who succeeded him. And they just were amazingly successful at fooling many and changing the opinions of many bishops. So in the East, the majority of the bishops signed various kinds of creeds that actually weakened or diminished or contradicted Nicaea. So, you know, the bishops, either wittingly or unwittingly in the East, most of them were fooled and were out there denying the full divinity of Christ. And this is after a council made it clear. So there were 55 years of battling until in 380, the situation was finally remedied. And even then, there was battling going on in individual areas in the church. So, I mean, when people are worried today about this bishop or that bishop contradicting Christian truth or not being strong enough, riding tall enough in the saddle, those are problems, all right, but they're nothing compared to what we went through in the fourth century. So anyway, that's one that I think we all need to be aware of, that we got through that. That the Lord brought us through. And I will mention that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, during that period was always one who was strongly committed to Nicaea. In fact, one Pope was exiled. He's put under house arrest because of his faithfulness to Nicaea and to the creed and to the truth of Jesus' divinity. But we're talking about a large number of bishops who were hoodwinked for quite a while. So anyway.
You know what? I'm looking at these lines just filling up, but perhaps we should take a few calls.
Okay.
All right. Graham and Jackson, listening on Good Shepherd Catholic Radio. You are up first. Your question for Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio.
All right. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. So my question is, as Catholics, if we have personal, verifiable, and, you know, with documentation, information that our bishops are placing people at risk, we have a duty to make that public, especially if our bishop refuses to change his ways.
Okay. Let me just say, Graham, I think that's a really good question, and it's a very appropriate question because just recently we have a pretty interesting situation with 60 Minutes interview of a gal, Ms. O'Connor, from the Diocese of Buffalo, who made public documents from the diocese that make clear that the bishop has been kind of allowing several people with credible accusations, several priests, to continue to function despite those accusations, despite the national bishop's policy that first credible accusation means that someone is relieved until such time as they are cleared, but they need to be relieved of their duty and put away from the possibility of, in case that the accusation is founded, to minimize the risk to everybody. So that's the national bishop's policy. This bishop is not following that and actually, in a certain way, hiding the truth, releasing names only of those who have died or have resigned, but holding back names of clergy who are active against whom there have been, credible accusations. So anyway, all of you who are listening to this can go out and look at that situation. And of course, I watched it. I followed it carefully. In her case, it seems to me like, she made a very clear and credible case that not revealing this information continues to leave many at risk. She was not under any sort of seal of the confessional, which is a complicating factor for many clergy who find out about stuff like this. So I personally think we are, and again, the Catholic teaching on conscience is that in complex circumstances, we have to listen to the voice of conscience, and that trumps a lot of things, and it's complicated. So there are individual judgments that need to be made. I think if I were in her position, I would have done the same thing. I was in a position somewhat similar to hers, a little bit, when I was spending some time in my theology school, and I was under I had sworn prior to listening and to anyone that I would remain – that this would remain confidential. I made an oath to that. I didn't have a credible witness. At that time, I thought I needed to maintain that oath of secrecy and not violate someone's confidence. So it's a very difficult situation. I think, honestly, what we need to do is pray for these situations when we see them occur in others. And when it comes right down to it, it's only us when we're in the situation that can make the call, guided by the Holy Spirit, and I think guided by a spiritual director. I think if you're in that situation, Graham, you ought to ask the advice of somebody that you really trust. Could be your priest, it could be your spouse, it could be, you know, but somebody who has spiritual maturity can help you discern it. So that's the way conscience works. Ultimately, it's the individual in the circumstance who has to make the call.
Graham, thank you for that call. I do hope that answer was helpful to you. Ray in Oklahoma City is listening on EWTN Radio. Ray, your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Yeah, I had a question about the Eastern Church and the schism that occurred there. I'm a relatively new convert, 2 years in, but my wife and I have been Protestant, and then coming to the church, we found that we've become more evangelistic than we were when we were evangelicals, which is funny. But the question is, I've been having conversations with others, both kind of lapsed Catholics and people from the Eastern Church who are of the, you know, Eastern Orthodox persuasion, and kind of, can you unpack that separation for me? And I know that the Catholic Church, at least to me, seems to be more reaching to kind of try to make something happen there, whereas the discussions I've had with many of my Orthodox friends seem to be very staunch and saying, "Oh no, the Bishop of Rome cut the ties when they changed the creed, and that's that. You don't mess with the creed, and it's done." So, can you unpack it a little bit and maybe give me some points on how to kind of reach out and build a bridge?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what, if we had an hour, I could do a much better job, but we don't. So, I'm going to say this. Most folks get a really skewed kind of a view of history, whether it be the Protestant Reformation split or the split between the East and the West. It didn't happen over one date, one mutual excommunication in 1054. It really didn't happen either, having to do with quote unquote changing the creed. It's really a matter of a drift and a breakdown of communication, just like in a marriage, that happens over a long period of time. It kind of started really in the 4th century and in the way in which the two halves of the empire started drifting apart culturally. And then there was separation because of the lack of the ability to travel, the barbarian invasions, Arab pirates. We kind of developed differently. And there were long periods of mutual excommunication and then reconciliation over a number of things, like the icon crisis, which a lot of times our Eastern brothers and sisters, they don't see that as one of the issues that led to strains in our relationship. But the East, unfortunately, was gripped through the emperor, through the Archbishop of Constantinople, with this wrong theology of we can't have images, and they started destroying images. That was one of the first schisms that we had, because Pope excommunicated both the emperor and the Archbishop of Constantinople because they were denying the use of images and destroying them and killing people who had them. So, you know, there's like on both sides, there are problems. On both sides, there were strains, bad, you know, kind of selfish and ambitious men on both sides, you know, were at fault for the breakdown. It's kind of a pitiful story. And it wasn't really completely final until, I would say, the fall of Constantinople in 1453. If you'd like to hear a good long breakout of this, you can go to my website, to dritaly.com, and there's a CD set. It's just two CDs. It's called Christianity Divided. And it's an hour kind of breakout on the Protestant Reformation and how that kind of played out, and also on the East-West Schism. The point is that the schism is tragic, and as Vatican II tells us, that men on both sides were to blame. And so our goal now should be, and is for many. You know, there are different kinds of Catholics. There are different kinds of Orthodox. There are some Catholics who have no interest in reconciling with the East and see it simply as the East has to submit to the Pope. And the East, there are people in the East who are hawks. And, you know, they think that we're heretics, Trinitarian heretics, etc. But there are also many Eastern priests and bishops who are very much in favor of rebuilding relationship with the Latin or the Catholic Church. So, you know, it really depends who you talk to. But what we need to do is we need to pray for reconciliation and for unity. And we need to work by seeking to understand each other and communicate with each other and build bonds of brotherhood. So anyway, that's what I would tell you in a nutshell on, you know, number one, that it's much more complicated than most people make it out to be, and it's really worth studying. And number two, that we all have an obligation to be praying regularly for restoration of unity and doing whatever we can to be ambassadors. Someone, I'll just say this finally, a friend of mine, Orthodox priest, said, "The wall went up one brick at a time." Oh. And the only way to take it down is one brick at a time. And each one of us has an opportunity to be part of that.
Ray, thanks very much for that question. Do you have any sense that maybe the fact that the general de-Christianizing of the culture and the pressure that puts on churches will bring us closer to one another because we face a real kind of enemy?
It absolutely should, and in many cases has. So we'll just have to see if all of us can be wise enough and holy and humble enough to allow that pressure to do what the Lord wants it to do, and that is purify and unify us.
Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio is our guest. You can find him at dritaly.com. He leads pilgrimages as well, and we'll talk about one to the Holy Land coming up when we come back. If you have questions or comments about crisis moments in the church, which is what we are talking about today, 888-318-7884 is the number.
This is Bishop Robert Baer, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. We asked 5 distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humanae Vitae from 5 perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Our goal in this life is to become saints in the next.
Who do you know who's closest to being a saint?
Share with us on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now let's return to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Halloween to you. Hey, if you're driving, be really careful now. This is the time to be really careful. And if you got kids who drive, send them a text and remind them to be really careful, because this is a crazy time out there, and we don't want any little people out there in their little, I don't know, with their lightsabers and their Ninja Turtles. And I don't know what people dress up. No, as their Olafs and their other Frozen characters out there getting hurt. So drive carefully for the rest of today, because, well, you know why. You know what's going on out there. 888-318-7884 is our number. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, and we are discussing crisis moments in the history of the Church. There's been some doozies. We've gotten to a couple. We'll get to some more. Before I do that, though, Dr. D'Ambrosio, a couple times I've given out your website, dritaly.com. What kind of things will people find there?
hey, they'll find a great article on All Saints Day, which is tomorrow, and how we ought to be celebrating it, as well as All Souls Day. Purgatory, prayers for the dead, where'd that come from? Halloween, you know, you guys are trying to do what I'm trying to do, and that is debunk this crazy notion that Halloween is a Druid pagan witch feast day that we appropriated. It's kind of like the other way around, honestly. But people need to know where the customs of Halloween come from, just to get rid of some of the crazy notions that are floating around out there on the internet and all. So anyway, they get a lot of great teaching podcasts, videos, but they also get information on how they can bring me in to speak in their area, at their parish or their men's conference. That's dritaly.com, dritaly.com. And then I lead pilgrimages to the Holy Land. And I have two coming up, and we have space on both. Some last-minute seats available for the one right after Christmas, and a few more seats available for the one right after Easter. And going to the Holy Land with me, it really – I think it's an awesome experience because I have a – we take a prayerful approach, and you learn more than a typical pilgrimage between the special guide that I have from the Holy Land, who's Arab Catholic. His sharing his perspective and me sharing a little bit more biblical and historical perspective than you usually get from guides. And we pray our way through. So it's an encounter with the Lord in these holy places. It's a life-changing experience. So if you'd like to come, just come to dritaly.com, click the pilgrimage tab at the top of every page, and that'll bring you to the information on the Holy Land pilgrimages.
DrItaly.com is the place to go. We go now to Jeffrey in Connecticut, watching on Facebook Live. Jeffrey, thanks so much for watching on Facebook Live. Your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Hi, guys. Big fan. Thanks, Dr. Italy, a few years ago for coming to Connecticut for a men's conference. My question is, given the current crisis of the priesthood and the scandal and the ecclesiastical and sexual corruption, how does this relate to the time of St. Peter Damian, and what effect does homosexual inclinations have on this?
Okay. Let me say this. It's a really good question. St. Peter Damian, for those of you who don't know about him, he was an abbot in the 11th century, and he later became bishop, which is not what he really wanted to do, but he was called on to become bishop. But the thing with Peter Damian is he saw tremendous amount of sexual abuse going on, and it was homosexual sexual abuse, which has always been a problem. Anytime you get men together, there's always, you know, an issue. So, you know, obviously the clergy, this is a concentration of men, so it's a temptation for those with that inclination, or for those who are unscrupulous and who are deliberately hypocritical, it's a great fishing ground for people with that inclination who have that kind of a bent. So he saw it happening. He brought it to the attention of authorities. He didn't see the Pope was handling it with a sufficient seriousness. So it's very similar to what people are, you know, upset about today. You know, the authorities not taking the right aggressive response to it and not you know, going after it and dealing with it properly. So that's really what we find. And anybody can get St. Peter Damian's book. You can search on St. Peter Damian and kind of find it. I think it's Gomorrah is the title of the book. So that's the thing about St. Peter Damian, very similar to our situation today. And I would say, if anything, it was worse. So the next thing is homosexuality. First of all, homosexual inclination. Pope Benedict said that people with a very strong homosexual inclination that has not been under control, that really shouldn't be folks admitted to orders. I would agree with the Pope on that. And I would say that there is a great problem. There's a problem with sexual abuse, both by heterosexual inclined people and homosexual inclined people in the clergy, for sure. But the problem with homosexuality is, number one, it really is, as much as people hate, you know, don't like this and all that, it's a disordered desire that opens, that is hard, I would say, especially in a men's context, when you have authority over other people and you're living with men and all that, there's a tremendous temptation for the thing to get out of control in terms of evil sexual activity. And the church's teaching is clear. It's just, and it's not going to change. I don't care what anyone out there thinks or says. It's natural law, and it's also clearly in Old and New Testament, that sexual expression is meant, is connected to the giving of life as well as the expression of affection. And so the only proper place for that is in heterosexual marriage, which is, it's crazy that we have to say heterosexual marriage. Marriage means a union of man and woman that's ordered towards the procreation and raising of children, as well as towards the mutual support of husband and wife. So for us, the sexual act means two things. One, it's the expression of the sacramental bond of union between a man and woman that is meant to last for as long as either one of them lives. It's lifetime. And number two, it's meant to be open towards, and it's ordered intrinsically towards the giving of new human life. So homosexual expression of sexual intimacy is always, in every case, wrong morally. So it can't be done by a Christian. And as much as people want to try to baptize it today, it can't be done. So yeah, the problem of homosexuality in the clergy is a serious problem. And there should be no one who's sexually active in the clergy. And I think that priests who have a sexual, have a homosexual orientation, and I know of several who are chaste, holy priests, ought to be supported and loved. But I would say that we need to be clear that men coming into the seminary life who have had serious problems with homosexuality and have not lived chastely and have lived out that sexual expression, I really don't think that this priesthood is the place for them. They can rise to the heights of holiness, but I don't think the priesthood is the proper place either for them in terms of their own holiness, being a great place of greater temptation, and also the problem of leading other people astray through this falling in this inclination. So anyway, that's what I would say in response to your question, Jeffrey.
And Jeffrey, there are just a ton of people lined up to ask Dr. D'Ambrosio questions, so we're going to keep moving. I hope that that was helpful to you. We're talking about crisis moments in the history of the church. If you have questions about the crisis moments in the history of the church or about this particular crisis moment in the church, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We go now to Simon in Atlanta. Thanks for waiting, Simon. Your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Yes, I have a question. Have you ever considered it that this may actually, crisis in Chinese means opportunity, that this may actually be a great, great opportunity for a church because, we are living in a world where with new technology we can actually address some issues we could not address before. Like in the past, if you had a horrible bishop, it was years of information to reach Vatican and back. And, it was difficult and there were political issues because, the king may be this bishop's brother and, to remove him was very difficult. But now we have actually for a first time opportunity to clean our top hierarchy, if a lay faithful are going to get involved, so I'm just thinking, instead of just thinking this is the worst of the times, this actually may be the best of the times because we can actually challenge, the bishops that fail and, and say, don't do this. We don't want you, and we have the power we didn't have it before, because before, if you were, if you stood up to the bishop, first of all, no one would hurt you, and many times bishop would have his own army and he could actually kill you if you stood up to him too much.
I think I feel like we've got a sense of the question, Simon, and we're short on time. Excuse me. Simon, we're short on time. So let's let Dr. D'Ambrosio respond. What do you make of that as a moment of opportunity?
Yes. Crisis means a moment of truth, and it does mean an opportunity. So I really agree with Simon, and it is a great opportunity for us to change a number of things. Now, I have to say, since 2002, there has been a change. We've become much more aware of the way sexual predators operate, and a lot of us in the church, if not all of us who do any kind of ministry, have to go through training that helps make it much easier to spot these kinds of issues and to deal with them. And so I think we've had a tremendous improvement. But I think right now the higher up clergy in the church, the bishops, the cardinals need to be more accountable. And I think it's an opportunity for us to see how lay people need to be involved more in the government of the church. Now, this doesn't mean that lay people ought to be taking over the role of the sacramental role of bishops by any means, or priests, or you know, taking over the role of being authoritative teachers. That's magisterium. But in terms of governance, it's fascinating. You know, in the early days of the church, bishops were elected by the laity, by the whole church, laity and clergy, and of course they had to be approved by local bishops and by the Pope. So it was a consensual process. The process that we have right now has a lot of problems, you know, in the way bishops are chosen and the way cardinals are chosen, in the sense that it's kind of opaque. And I think that right now there's lots of great questions being asked about that. And they're okay questions to ask. They're not disobedient. They're not, rebellious questions to ask. For example, the independent lay review boards that are being brought in more increasingly to help discern these things, I think that's really a healthy thing. It's a really good thing. And I think we need to pray. I don't want to be on one of those. That's a horrible job, if you ask me. But I think we need to pray for those who are being called. I have a friend that I was just visiting with in the island of Malta, who's being called to participate in such a board. So we need to pray for that and see this as an opportunity for us to move forward in purification, in helping to develop better structures, better processes, you know, as well as personal holiness. I mean, processes are important, but also personal holiness is important, and a call to personal holiness is. And that's really what All Saints Day is all about. We're all called to the heights of holiness. So that's appropriate to be talking about today.
Simon, thank you very, very much for that call and for that question. Right now, Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, free ebook from Catholic Answers is available. If you'd like to get that free ebook, Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, you just go to the Catholic Answers Facebook page and sign up, and they'll send you that free book. We're not trying to get anything from you. We're just trying to give it to you. So go ahead and get it over there at the Catholic Answers page on Facebook, Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, a free ebook available right now.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
We need Catholic radio because we need the voice of the church in the public forum. We live in a time that the secular voice dominates so thoroughly that we need to get that Catholic perspective out. Just as Fulton Sheen used radio and TV in the last century, we need to continue to use. This means to announce the Catholic faith in the public forum.
Bishop Robert Barron thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. As you know, it's Halloween, and happy Halloween to you and yours, and drive carefully, please. And second hour, our chaplain will be here, Father Hugh Barber, and we'll take chaplain-type questions. If you have need of a chaplain for a pastoral question, a question about your prayer life, a question about family life, a question about marital status, all those things that we usually ask chaplains, that's what the chaplain comes in here to do, and you are welcome to call next hour. This hour, we'll discuss crisis moments in the history of the church with Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio. This is one of the topics that he will come to your parish or event and talk about. And you'd be very happy to have him, I am sure, indeed. And there's a great deal of hope that comes from reflecting on 2,000 years of crisis following upon crisis, because it's easy. It helps us to remember the Lord is still with His church. He didn't give up, and His ways are not our ways. And these things have a way of working out to the best. For example, you talked a bit about the Arian controversies, but think of how clear the creeds are and how helpful they are to us understanding who Jesus is, for example, because of the response to that crisis. I wonder if there's any other crises, Dr. D'Ambrosio, that you look back on and you go, well, here are some very important things that came out of that we can actually be thankful for.
Yeah, absolutely, Cy. First, I'm going to say that every single heresy that's come up in the history of the church, the Arian heresy denying Christ's divinity, but there's a whole lot of other ones that came up as well, okay? And I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I'm just going to say that every single one was used by the Lord providentially. Now, this does not exculpate the heretics who attacked the truth and were obstinate and wouldn't listen to the authority of the church, okay? That they were wrong. But I'm just saying that the Lord, in his goodness, like Romans 8 says, for those who love God and are called in his plan, everything can work out for the good. And that's the great thing about divine providence. It takes evil, like the cross, and makes it an instrument of good. It turns the devil against himself. And that's what's happened with heresies. They forced us to reflect more deeply and to come to greater clarity about the Trinity, about the humanity and divinity of Jesus, about the reality of the Eucharist and all the sacraments. And getting to that, you know, that was that big problem was the Protestant Reformation. Now, the Protestant Reformation, again, those who caused schism, I'd hate to have to answer for that, you know. So I'm not going to canonize any of those people who were involved in causing schism. But the people, the Protestant Reformation was reforming, it was responding to a church at that time in the beginning of the 16th century that was in really tough shape in lots of ways. Clergy were illiterate. We had no seminary system. St. Peter Canisius, in the midst of the Reformation, went over to Poland trying to bring Poland back. It initially kind of went with the Protestant Reformation, the Lutheran Reformation. So he went there to try to win them back, which was successful. However, he said in his travels, he could scarcely find a priest who was not living in open concubinage, which means, obviously, cohabitating with a woman outside of marriage. So the point I'm trying to make here is the Protestant Reformation was responding to tremendous corruption on lots of levels in the church, bad theology that was being taught, not heretical doctrinal teaching by the church, but a kind of theological system that emphasized human effort and wasn't appreciating grace and was actually you could see how a scrupulous person could be easily tormented by the kind of spirituality and theology that had developed at the beginning of the 16th century. Okay, now so the big problems, and the church was slow in dealing with them because lots of the clergy, the higher clergy, were nobility and were not there for the right reasons. They had valid orders, but they didn't have souls that were on fire for Jesus Christ, and that includes a number of popes. Okay, so the Protestant Reformation forced the church, to respond in renewal. And the Council of Trent, the many religious orders that were developed during the time, the Council of Trent mandated the first seminary system to deal with ignorance and immorality among the clergy and start giving better formation to the clergy. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the Lord sometimes uses crises, as it was said earlier, like this crisis, to prod his church to reform and renewal and repentance. So we should cooperate with that. Just like the Lord used the Babylonians to judge the people of Israel, and bringing them to Babylon caused them to be purified and to become much more serious about their Jewish identity as the people of God. So I think the Lord uses sometimes the persecution of the world and the press to lead us to change, so that we should be grateful for that and cooperate with that and be humble about that.
I am shocked to hear that you might think that the press would have an agenda regarding the Catholic Church. That is, we'll discuss that another time. Monsignor Bill is on the line. Monsignor Bill, thanks for your call, your question or comment for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
I was just going to call attention to the newest edition of CARA, research report. That's the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate out of Georgetown University. They show the trend on clergy sexual abuse of minors. And in the last 3 years nationwide, there have been 22 allegations, an average of 7 a year. But if we go back to the 1970s, it was about 300 to 400 a year. So the church is making progress in this crisis. And I think we need to maybe ask people to call upon a virtue of perspective, if I might use that word, for a virtue that we are learning from the past. We can't fix the past. We can't erase it, but we can learn from it. And in my diocese, Galveston, Houston, we have trained 135,000 adults, clergy, volunteers, teachers, in child protection, etc. So I think we are making those changes.
Is that possible, Dr. D'Ambrosio, that that's one of those things that's not that you want to say brings good out of evil, but those one of those good things that God has given to us as a consequence of this current crisis?
I think so, Si, and I thank you very much, Monsignor Bill, for bringing this to the attention of our listeners here. And I would recommend that people take a look at that study. And CARA, as well as Pew Research Center, just have phenomenal stats and research on all sorts of different things, but on this matter. And we definitely have made progress. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I've seen it, and I'm one of the people who went through that training. And I'm grateful for it. I maintain it every year and update it. So I really do think it's pretty amazing the progress we've made. And I think this new crisis, it's shown a spotlight on seminaries. And it's also shown a spotlight on, you know, the fact that perhaps we haven't taken as seriously the sexual abuse of adults. And so, I mean, I think people are scrambling, including bishops. I think some of our bishops have made great statements, are taking great action. So, I mean, we're looking obviously at people who haven't taken good action. And that's regrettable, and they need to be called to account for that. But we have bishops who are seeking to go beyond the protection of legal minors to the protection of adults. And I would say any adult who is young, like a seminarian, is vulnerable. So the protection of any, you know, all adults from any kind of sexual harassment, that's really important. And the accountability of bishops is very, very important for their personal behavior as well as for cover-up. So we're making progress. And these are the next areas to make progress in. And I think we've already started making progress in those areas. Thank God.
Monsignor Bill, thank you very, very much for your contribution. That was very helpful. Let's try to get to Robert in Missouri, listening on 88.1 FM before we have to go. Robert, you're going to have to make it kind of quick to let Dr. D'Ambrosio respond. No, Robert?
Robert is there?
Oh, hi, Robert.
Yes. Quickly, I've coined a phrase in terms of dealing with the struggle that's going on contemporarily, entitled "We're in the Times of the Gauntlet, Trying to Devour the Chalice." This is referring to relativism, worldliness, and existentialism eating away at the Catholic Church. And I was just wondering if when the Church changed from Latin to English, if this opened the door for this kind of threat.
Okay, Robert. I want to say that, in my opinion, the use of vernacular in the liturgy has absolutely nothing to do with the rise of relativism. Unfortunately, we find St. Justin Martyr in the second century noting that relativism is being a big problem. And that was a time when the church didn't speak Latin or English, it spoke Greek. So unfortunately, relativism has been around for a while, and it's rearing its ugly head in a big way in Western civilization and has been for quite some time. There was a battle with relativism actually in a heresy called modernism. You may have heard of that. And that was at the turn of the 20th century when the church was speaking Latin. So anyway, relativism is a problem, and that's a big problem with sexual ethics. Relativism basically says there's no objective reality, no objective truth, and so we can make it up for ourselves, each person. It's subjectivism also, because, you know, each person is what he feels he or she is. And that's what we see with transgenderism right now. So the church needs to fight that because it kills people. I mean, to think that you can fly and jump off a high building, you know, that's a subjective idea, but it doesn't jive with reality. And you find that out when you meet the ground. And that's, people are finding that out through venereal disease, through just horrible suffering that comes along with sexual sin. So I think the church needs to be very, very clear in love about its sexual teaching and be proud of it, because it's a gift to the church. It's and a gift to the world, and we need to model it joyfully. We don't want to just wag our fingers at relativists and people who are relativizing sexual ethics and just say naughty, naughty. We need to be able to show the beauty of Christian marriage, the beauty of Christian objective truth, and call people to that. Invite them to it gently and welcome them to it. I think someone said evangelism is like one beggar telling another beggar where the food is. So one sinner to another sinner showing where truth is, which is food for our soul. Let's do that.
Thank you, Robert, for that call. Thank you, Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, for a very fine hour. Oh, did we lose him? Well, don't forget, you can find out all about Dr. D'Ambrosio at DrItaly.com. DrItaly.com. Thank you, Doctor. And we'll see you next hour for The Chaplain Is In with Father Hugh Barber.